This is Law and Disorder.
This week on Law and Disorder, we'll be talking about the first lawsuit against private contractor Blackwater in Iraq.
Private contractors are an increasing danger to people all over the world. You'll hear about one of them, Blackwater USA.
We'll do a follow-up story on the increasing presence of surveillance cameras throughout New York City.
Thinking of jaywalking? Bicycling in the wrong direction? Hitting your boyfriend? Don't do it. You'll be watched.
The FBI is seeking to look through nearly 200 boxes of archival material collected by investigative reporter Jack Anderson.
Jack Anderson, one of the most famous muckraking reporters of his time, would roll over in his grave before he turned over one sheet of paper to the FBI.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Approximately half a year ago, Law and Disorder interviewed Bill Brown. We took a look at the number of surveillance cameras that are installed all around the boroughs of Manhattan. Cameras that you may not be aware are watching you 24 hours a day. Recently, we learned that 500 new cameras of a new technology are being installed with funding from the Department of Homeland Security. With us once again on the street is Bill Brown to talk about what this means for our civil liberties. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Bill.
Thank you very much, Heidi. Good to be back.
Since we last spoke, apparently 505 new surveillance cameras are being installed in New York.
Yes, that's right. They're the beginnings of 505 new New York City Police Department cameras, and they're being installed at first in Brooklyn, and from what the news reports say, they will be mostly concentrated in Brooklyn because these are where the so-called high-impact areas are of crime, where they're trying to focus their energies, and the cameras are being loaded on top of the high-impact neighborhoods.
And high-impact is where there are high crime rates.
As crime is, you know, reflected in this city, which is people who are actually complaining about it, so it's really the war on drugs still being fought. The place where these first cameras are going up is the Maria Hernandez Park, a city park, and Maria Hernandez was actually a local mom who was campaigning against drug dealing in her neighborhood and was killed in 1989. So presumably there's still a problem with the sales of illegal drugs by gun-bearing criminals. So I don't want to minimize the fact that there is indeed crime in this neighborhood. What will come up actually as we get really into the subject is why is Homeland Security funds, anti-terrorist funds, being used to install cameras that are going into an area simply because the crack dealers and marijuana dealers are fighting it out as they always have been? Why is $10 million in federal monies going into this area?
Were federal funds being used in the past, or is this a new development?
This is a brand new development. In the past, New York City has funded its own camera schemes, which means it's had to come out of pocket or out of city or state funds. And this is the first time that federal, that is Homeland Security grants, are being used for local cameras. So New York is finally getting its share of the take of federal funds in the same way that Washington, D.C., Chicago, and some other cities have already gotten their federal monies.
Now, is this costing this first wave of cameras about $9 million?
That's right.
Is it $81 million in federal grants are still pending?
Yes, that's right, because there are a number of different initiatives that are on the table. So it's important when we speak about surveillance cameras in New York City today to think of what authority is installing them where. We were talking about the NYPD cameras anti-crime in Brooklyn, and the further proposal that would bring in another $81 million of federal monies is creating a so-called ring of steel in downtown Manhattan, which would be a literal and physical barrier around the financial district, and that's modeled on what they have in London, where they're in this one area, the city, their economic center, there are 10,000 surveillance cameras equipped with license plate recording, recognizing cameras, so that within 6 seconds of driving your car underneath one of these cameras, you can be identified exactly. And that's what they're proposing to bring to Manhattan as well.
The ring of steel.
Yes, and it's also a literal, it's not just cameras, it would also be physical barriers, guard posts, it would be a militarization of downtown.
So there would be personnel as well as equipment.
Oh, personnel as in moving personnel in stationary barricades. For example, in Park Row near City Hall, as a matter of fact, there are also very similar conditions that after September 11th, they blocked off all of the traffic that goes underneath One Police Plaza, which cut off traffic to all of Chinatown. And there were not only cameras, but personnel and vehicles and barriers of all sorts. And that's what's being imagined with surveillance in the Wall Street area.
How effective, in your opinion, are these additional cameras? What kind of personnel are monitoring what the cameras see? Is that in place now?
Well, there are no guidelines whatsoever for who monitors the cameras, which is important because you need background checks. You also need supervisors who are watching the watchers, and the supervisors know what to look out for. And you want to train people in advance without having to discover abuses later. But what's happening in the most contemporary surveillance is that, as is what's happening now in Brooklyn with the new cameras, is that 8 different command centers can get the images from the cameras. So that way, just because somebody in the 83rd precinct isn't watching, somebody in the 82nd or at One Police Plaza or someplace else. So they've multiplied the number of potential watchers by the type of thing they've placed there. And that's typical of the new surveillance as well, is that you don't have to be sitting in a certain building to see the cameras. You can be virtually anywhere with the new technology.
Now, is the Department of Homeland Security the ultimate overseer of all of this? Who has responsibility for the information?
No, they just provide a grant, and that the ultimate overseer remains the grant recipient, who actually installs, probably contracts out to Camera Eye, which is the maker of these particular systems. But they will be actually administered and watched by the New York City Police Department, so Homeland Security will not be involved in the watching. But it is a question about the priority of funds, because in this particular neighborhood, I would dare say that the local schools, maybe the fire department, the other infrastructures of civilian society need the money a lot more than cameras that cost $20,000 per installation. That's how you get to $9.8 million, is if you just do the simple math. 500 cameras means that each one of these is an average family's income.
I've heard that these new cameras emit a beam.
The new cameras are wireless cameras. They work by Wi-Fi, and we usually associate that with, say, in Bryant Park. You can take your laptop, any laptop, and hook into a Wi-Fi beam. It's publicly available. The same thing can be done with these surveillance cameras, with the exception of the fact that they're password-protected websites. So that means with the new technology, the cameras are actually transmitting out into the open air their signals, and that you could be anywhere you want to be if with a laptop, a BlackBerry, a dashboard installation, anything like that, where you know the frequency and the password, you can tap into it. That's the benefit of it. The downside is that they're constantly emitting microwave radiation. And that I would like to know, I would ask the NYPD or Homeland Security, is did their fellows at the FCC examine these camera broadcasting installations to see that they're actually safe to have in residential areas? Because they're constantly on, they have direct point-to-point beams, and if you're within that radius of the point-to-point beams over 10, 20, 30 years, you may develop serious health problems. So obviously, if they're rushing new cameras out onto the ground, there can barely be enough research done done, not only in terms of what these do to people's rights and expectations of privacy, but their health as well.
Bill, do the communities in which these cameras are being installed know about the cameras installation?
They can't possibly know what's going on there. And I base this not only about what I've read in the news reports, but being contacted by reporters in the mainstream media, and not one of them realized that these are OCTV cameras, open circuit television. They are live broadcast cameras. So they'll refer to them as closed circuit television, as CCTV, refer to them in various ways, and they don't realize what technologically makes them cost $20,000 per installation rather than $200 or $2,000. So the people in the neighborhoods can't possibly understand what the cameras can do for them or with them or against them, because the people who are asking them the questions, the news reporters, they themselves don't understand the technology. And I know that because I've been interviewed, and they will write very, very careful notes when I just say, this is the difference between this new set of cameras and the ones that you might see, say, at City Hall, where all around us there are not OCTV cameras, but CCTV. And that's been the jump.
Is iCamera the sole manufacturer of these?
I haven't yet actually been to Knickerbocker Avenue, so I've seen a photograph that shows a Camera Eye makes it. And of course, Googling for Camera Eye brings up almost a million hits. And I'm trying to ascertain if it is indeed ACS, which is the subsidiary or subcontract from Lockheed Martin. Because to be able to build cameras with this sophistication requires really intense research and production facilities. And it's a good guess, because especially that in a lot of the new subway stations, there's another camera initiative going in, which is 1,000 new cameras made by Lockheed Martin through not the New York City Police Department, but the MTA police. And they are going up right now all around us, and they are not wireless as the ones in Brooklyn, but they're fiber optically linked cameras, which are, again, cutting-edge technology. For the people who don't know what that means, is that it's noiseless transmission. You can lay a fiber optic cable next to a power cable, and the signal won't become blurry or distorted or interfered with. And especially when you're laying in 1,000 cameras into the subway systems, various sloppily installed electrical circuits are a big problem. So that people will be startled when they realize the quality of these pictures, that they will not be the blurry pictures that you see on television or on the police blotter and, say, the Daily News, which always has grainy pictures. That's because they're not using digital cameras linked fiber optically.
What are you specifically doing to educate people about this new wave of cameras?
Well, the first thing that I did is I wrote a piece that then got published on the New York City Independent Media, and they made it a feature where I went through the various media reports, and instead of criticizing the articles, which is easy enough, looked at the type of photographs that they were using to illustrate the article. And the Associated Press's photograph was taken from low down at the ground, and you couldn't really see the cameras. So you couldn't see how monstrous they looked, and you certainly couldn't see the key thing, which is the transmitters. And I use that as a visual metaphor by saying the AP literally can't see and literally isn't showing people what's new about these cameras, because they're looking at it from literally the wrong perspective. They're looking up at them with admiration instead of looking down at them as the most desperate act of very cynical people.
What would you recommend that our listeners do if they want to take action to protest this new wave of cameras?
I'm really not sure. I know that action is desperately needed, because the watershed moment has indeed arrived. And I don't think people realize that this year, if these initiatives are completed, this year and next year, Manhattan is going to become a very different place, a much more unfriendly, hostile, suspicious place because of all the cameras. So that I think whatever it is that people are motivated to do, it's not a question of what they should do, but now is absolutely the time. Places that you should obviously go is to the American Civil Liberties Union, which is trying to pressure the city council to produce some sort of regulations. They can mostly probably do that because that is a center of activity. I'd also, as always, encourage people to come on the walking tours that I give every single Sunday so that they could get familiar with the technology. So it's easy for them with comfort to talk to people who might be suspicious of their ideas or inquisitive, so that they have the background to be able to answer questions confidently.
So education is a crucial component here. where do our listeners find out about your walking tours? Do you have a website?
The best thing, instead of spitting out a whole bunch of URL babble, is if people just Google search for surveillance camera players, they'll quickly find themselves to the site, or just walking tours. Each of the ones that we will talk about will be bring up these issues, and I'm thinking that I will now what we'll need to do to respond to this new initiative is offer walking tours where the new cameras are going up. So there's never been a walking tour in Brooklyn. It now seems that it's important that there is one, because that's where the action is taking place.
Bill, it's been a chilling update for us here, and we hope to talk to you again in 6 months and see some progress in this new arena.
Thank you, and I'm also happy to contact you and BIA's listeners every time I appear on your show and on BIA in general. The response is instantaneous, well-informed, and excited, not depressed or dispirited, and I look forward to the response that this appearance will inevitably generate.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome.
If you have thoughts on this segment, check out our blog, lawanddisorder.org. We'd like to know what you're thinking.
Recently deceased Jack Anderson was an American newspaper columnist and is considered one of the fathers of modern investigative journalism. The FBI is now seeking to look through the files of Jack Anderson to remove classified material they think he may have accumulated during his 40 years of reporting. Anderson's family has refused to permit a search of the nearly 200 boxes, claiming that a government search would betray his father's principles and send a chilling message to journalists. Last week, the New York Times reported that the family said they would go to jail to protect the collection, which is currently housed at George Washington University, awaiting cataloging. Joining us today is Jack Siggins, librarian at George Washington University. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Hi, Jack. This is Michael Ratner as well. Thanks for being with us. It's such an important story.
You're very welcome.
Jack, could you give our listeners a brief overview of what's happening with the FBI seeking to look through the files of Jack Anderson?
It's an ongoing kind of situation. We are waiting for, I think, the other shoe to drop from the FBI. The Anderson family, as represented by the son, Kevin Anderson, has decided to not to allow the FBI to have access to the collection. George Washington University and the library are holding the collection. They actually have it in the repository state. We do not actually have it deeded to us yet, although we were right on the verge of doing that when the FBI decided to get interested in the collection, and we decided that it was better to hold off on that actual sign over until this matter with the FBI had been resolved.
Meaning, where are being held right now?
It's being held in a storage facility.
Can you just remind our listeners about Jack Anderson, who he is, what he did, why he became so well known?
Certainly. Jack Anderson took over a very important column from Drew Pearson, and Anderson was, both of them were, columnists who investigated and followed up on leaks and various stories that occurred, especially in the Washington, D.C. area involving government and government officials and so forth. Jack Anderson actually wrote a column and had a radio program for 35 or 40 years. He continued that right up to the time he became ill with Parkinson's disease some years ago. He had a great influence on an array of issues going back to, and including such things as the Watergate episode. He was on just about every government official's hate list, I think, as a result of some of the articles and exposing various areas of misfeasance or malfeasance in the government.
He was a muckraker.
Thank you.
and on occasion, you know, I think, I don't know if our listeners all know this, but classified documents, to the extent that journalists rely on them, that's not illegal, as long as they're not the ones that have access to the classified documents in official capacity. So if somebody in the government turns over a document to a journalist, that journalist cannot be prosecuted for use of that document. And I presume that what the FBI is saying here, I don't know, I'm interested in what they said to you, how you got notice about it, that they think some of the documents in how many boxes are there?
188.
188?
Yes.
188. That some of those documents the FBI is probably claiming might have been classified at some point. I don't really know, but did they send you a letter? What did they do?
They actually, as far as I'm aware, what they did was to make direct inquiries and started an investigation around the perimeter of the organization and the university here. Called secretaries, they called various people who they thought actually could give them some information as to the location and status of the collection, and contacted eventually the university through its general counsel's office to inquire about it. There have been negotiations ever since among the family, the university, a general counsel's office, and myself, and as well as a faculty member here, Mark Feldstein, who is writing a biography of Jack Anderson.
But the university and the family don't want to give the access to
absolutely
the FBI.
Not. No, absolutely not. And we're all in agreement on that. We think it's a fundamental challenge to the access to information and to the whole question of putting the squeeze on reporters who come across this kind of information that's absolutely critical to the American public.
And hasn't the family said that they'll actually even go to jail rather than give up the documents?
Yes, in fact. Kevin Anderson said, even my 79-year-old mother is happy to go to jail on this issue, as well as Kevin himself. The family feels very strongly about this, and so we're abiding by what they want to do, and certainly we're in agreement with
them. This is like synonymous with Jack Anderson. I mean,
yes.
The idea that he in his life would ever turn over a document to the FBI is extraordinary.
Yes, and in fact, Kevin Anderson has said his father would love to be in the middle of all this because this is just exactly the kind of issue that he would have raised.
How old is the collection, really? I mean, how current is it?
Well, the collection, Jack Anderson kept an index, a very detailed index of all his contacts and so forth, and that in itself has a great value. Going back to the 40s and the 50s, and carrying up to the at least to the late 80s and early 90s.
So really, what we have here is the FBI looking at documents, the latest, as you said, the early 90s. So they're at least 10 or 12 or 14 years old.
At least.
And calling them classified.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And I think the documents that they have particular interest in involves the AIPAC issue. At least that's what they've claimed. And they're looking for something which will support that case and the charges against the lobbying group, the Israeli lobbying group.
Right. The what you're referring to is American-Israeli PAC.
That's right.
And there's indictments around the sharing of classified information, at least not with Jack Anderson, but with some other people, I think,
yes.
Recently.
And that's really a stretch because, as you say, the documents now are... I fail to see the relevance.
Is there any precedence for this? I mean, have you ever heard of it happening before? You're a librarian, you're a GW, you know, I mean...
Well, the FBI are always prowling around the libraries, especially academic libraries, because we provide access to a lot of users. They want to know what books they've checked out. In fact, there's been quite a bit of an engagement, according to what I've been told here at the university, by the FBI with our information systems here to try to get access to all of the... records of the students and faculty here.
Really? All the records of the students and faculty?
In terms of what books they check out, who they contact, what kind of activity.
How has the university responded to that?
Told them to go take a hike.
Now, that could be done under, you know, that's what some of the arguments around the Patriot Act are about.
Exactly.
About using provisions to do exactly that. But that it seems to be such a blanket request for essentially they want to look at every student at GW's checkout records?
Exactly right. Not just the books that they check out, but all the communication, the emails that they've had. And, of course, there's no way that we can do that. It is a fishing expedition, and the university is not going along with that.
Well, good for you guys. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, I'd heard that it was specific that the FBI going after a particular student might be a Muslim, but to say that they want a sort of blanket look at what people are checking out is extraordinary.
I suspect that GW is not the only one, obviously, that is involved in this kind of thing.
No, I presume it's across the country.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But is this the first time the FBI has asked to look into archival material?
So far as I'm aware, it is the first time that certainly at GW, I frankly can't speak for other universities. It's not normal practice.
So give me a timeline. You guys, everybody's still in negotiations with the FBI.
Right.
And, you know, well, you don't know what the FBI is going to do, whether they would wind up going to court, whether they'll figure out something else.
Exactly. Kevin Anderson, through his attorney here in Washington, issued a letter, a response to the FBI. The FBI had submitted a request to the family and, of course, the university as a party to this to have access to the collection. They wanted to have blanket access just to walk through all the boxes and take whatever they wanted. Kevin Anderson said, we'll get back to you, and they issued a letter, as you know, early in this week, which said no. Now there's been quite a bit of response and reporting of responses from the FBI who who think that this has been blown all out of proportion. So we're waiting to see what the FBI is going to do next.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've done very well on the publicity front. I mean, I think the news, even on the regular media, has been just amazed by it. They show pictures of the boxes. They,
right.
This is Jack Anderson. What are we talking about here?
Right.
So I sense that the sympathy is with you, and it's an embarrassing moment for the FBI. But we never, they don't somehow seem to press on despite that sometimes.
Sometimes they do. We'll just have to wait and see.
Well, good for you, and good luck with this, and our best.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Heidi, I thought the interview was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the Jack Anderson stuff is amazing enough, but in that, he dropped a nugget that I had never heard before, which is that the FBI has asked to see the book checkouts and the email of every single student at GW who uses the library.
That is extraordinary.
I mean, because all we've seen so far is individual cases where they go after an individual who they claim they need the information for a terrorist investigation.
But this is everyone
who uses it. This is everyone, and he said he didn't think it was the only library in the country. That is amazing to me, and it just demonstrates how far along the road to Big Brother we're going.
But heartening that the university is not giving in, and I hope they stand strong on this.
Well, on the Anderson stuff, I think they'll never give in.
Yeah.
And on the other stuff,
the family would probably rather destroy the materials than give it over.
I think that's right. What I would like to call these guys, the FBI guys, just sick, but it's worse than that because they're really nasty and dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, we're dealing with a very critical and crucial time. Most crucial and critical time that I've ever witnessed. Being as young as I am, you know. We all don't want to say nothing else, so we say as young as we are. Now I want to talk about the pronunciation and the realization. Now the educators, they call it ESP, positive thinking, right? Some of the people on the cross other side of the pond call it vibes, vibrations, astrology, and all those different things, you understand? But I call what it is what it is. What it is what it is. Look at him. Now you see, a brother, you take in the ghetto, you find a whole lot of crime. I can understand, I know what it means. Being 9 years old before I got my first pair on the way out of a store. You know, putting on a half pressed suit from the pawn shop. With tennis shoes, trying to be hip, so I know where it's coming from. Like the fella say, having catfish head stew. And look like the catfish went in there with his head and come out very quick and didn't leave nothing else. Now it's one thing the educators and the politicians and the establishment gotta remember. Now brothers need jobs. Don't work, you can't eat. If you don't work, you can't eat. Get hip to yourself, good God, my brother, and get it from the street. If you don't work, you can't eat. Sis, if you don't work, Lord, you can't eat. So you got to have mind power to deal with starvation.
Our next segment is about Blackwater, USA. That's a private contractor that had sent many, many people over to Iraq to work on behalf of the U.S. military. But they are a private contractor. As people may recall, a couple of years ago, four of the contractors were killed in Fallujah. It resulted eventually in the U.S. wiping out, obliterating Fallujah. Since that time, the families of those four contractors have now sued Blackwater USA, which was the contractor to work for. Today, we're going to have two of the people to talk about that, Jeremy Scahill, a well-known journalist, works for The Nation, Democracy Now!, Independent, recently wrote an article on it in The Nation. And we're going to speak with Mark Miles, who's a lawyer for the four families who's suing Blackwater USA on a claim that the four men who were killed were defrauded by Blackwater. It's an interesting case, and of course it will bring to light really the role of private contractors in Iraq and the increasing role they're having all over the world on behalf of the United States, really private security forces that have no accountability and are really free, unfortunately, to roam around and do a lot of harm. Jeremy Scahill, independent reporter for Democracy Now! As well as The Nation, and Mark Miles, an attorney for four of the families whose relatives were murdered in Fallujah. Jeremy, why don't you tell us first, you just came out with an article in The Nation about those four murders, what they were, and the fact that there is a lawsuit pending, and then we'll speak to Mark about that.
Thank you, first of all, for having us. I think this is a case that that everyone in this country needs to know about for a number of reasons. One is that when we generally think of corruption in Iraq, you think of overcharging the government, you know, the Halliburton, Bechtel, DynCorp world of things. What's unique about this case that we're going to be talking about here, we're talking about a lawsuit that alleges that the Blackwater Security Company is culpable for wrongful death and fraud. And that's what makes this a groundbreaking, precedent-setting case. People may remember this incident on March 31st, 2004, when four private security contractors with Blackwater USA were ambushed in the city of the Iraqi city of Fallujah. Their bodies were dismembered by a mob and dragged through the streets, and then the remains of two of the men were hung from a bridge over Fallujah. This attack happened shortly after Sheikh Yassin was assassinated by the Israeli government, and there was a lot of outrage and belief that the CIA had been involved with that. And there are some reports that indicate that the Iraqis that attacked these Blackwater security contractors, that they believe that they were in the CIA, and that was part of the attack itself. And that's very common in Iraq, where people think private security contractors are with the Central Intelligence Agency. And so I've done a lot of reporting on what happened to the people of Fallujah after this incident, but I never really studied or understood the events leading up to those four men ending up in the city of Fallujah. Because when you think about it, it's sort of remarkable. To my knowledge, no Iraqis were killed that day by the Blackwater guys in Fallujah. The reason that would be unusual is because the four men who were killed that day were all serious veterans of U.S. Special Forces. One of them, Scott Helvenston, was the youngest Navy SEAL ever. He had trained Demi Moore for her movie G.I. Jane, was literally the poster boy for the U.S. Navy 1 year, I believe even 2 years. And so how was it that these guys ended up ambushed and killed with all their years of combat experience, essentially by people just walking up and shooting them at close range with small arms? And so in the process of looking into that, I came across the fact that these four families of the men killed had filed a lawsuit against Blackwater USA.
And that brings us really to Mark. Mark, you're representing the four families, and I guess it's against Blackwater. But why don't you tell us, one, who the plaintiffs are, where you filed the case, and really what are the allegations against Blackwater?
Yeah, that's right. And thank you for having me on, Michael and Heidi. My firm, Callahan and Blaine, and I are representing those four families. And we've brought a wrongful death and fraud cause of action against Blackwater Security Consulting, which is located in North Carolina. The lawsuit is essentially to hold Blackwater accountable for their wrongful conduct that led to these men's death. We're operating in the unique situation where we have private security contractors in Iraq. The problem with that is there is absolutely no accountability for the contractors themselves or the American corporate companies that are employing them. They are operating outside of the military structure, which means they're not subject to court-martial, they're not subject to any type of chain of command or accountability from the government. At the same time, they're working in a country like Iraq, which really doesn't have the police force to enforce wrongful conduct or to hold anybody responsible. You take that unique situation and then you add into the mix corporate profits. And what we have here is an American company, which I understand cut costs, which ultimately led to the death. What really happened is that Blackwater made a series of representations to these men about the type of vehicle they would be traveling in. They specifically said it would be an armored vehicle. About the number of men that were supposed to be in each mission. Each mission was supposed to have six men, two vehicles, three people in each vehicle, which provided for driver, a navigator, and a rear gunner. And they were supposed to be able to do pre-trip inspections of the route, risk assessment of the route to determine if it's too dangerous. And of course, once these gentlemen got over to Baghdad, they weren't provided with any of this. On March 31st, 2004, when they were killed, they were not in armored vehicles. That's because Blackwater, as I understand it, saved $1.5 million to pad their bottom line in not buying armored vehicles. They were not operating in teams of six. There were only two men in each vehicle, which essentially took away the rear gunner and didn't allow the men to protect themselves from people approaching from the rear. So this case is about holding Blackwater accountable, but also to create accountability in this whole private military scheme that's going over in Iraq, and to send a message to the other private military firms that they have to understand the commodity that they're dealing with, and that commodity is human.
Mark, is this the first lawsuit against Blackwater?
It is a precedent-setting lawsuit, and it is the first lawsuit against Blackwater for the contractors over there in Iraq. And in fact, it's the first lawsuit of its kind concerning any of the private military firms in Iraq.
Where has the lawsuit been filed, and what's been the response so far?
Well, that's an interesting question. The lawsuit was filed in North Carolina State Court, and the response so far from Blackwater has been complete stonewalling. Initially, they improperly removed the case to federal court. I filed a motion to remand, and the federal district court sent the case back to North Carolina State Court for us to proceed. Fortunately, Blackwater continued its stonewalling efforts and filed a federal appeal of that remand order.
Why would they want it in federal court? Is there an advantage to that for them?
I think it's not only to keep the case in federal court, but essentially to stonewall and stall the case so that it doesn't go forward, because Blackwater can accomplish nothing by this case actually proceeding along.
Is Blackwater the only defendant in the case?
Blackwater is not. There is an individual defendant, Justin McCowan, who was the program manager at the time. We present evidence that he had a personal animosity toward one of the contractors and that he took that animosity out on the contractor, which contributed to the ultimate death.
Just to flesh a little bit more of that out, Mark, I want to back up for one second and say, you know, I think from my perspective, having covered Fallujah for a long time, one could say, and I've actually gotten, since this article came out, a lot of angry emails from people saying these guys were mercenaries, they got what they deserved. One could go down that road, but actually I think this case is a little bit more complicated than that. These guys signed contracts, the four men who were killed, that basically laid out every possible way a human being could be killed, maimed, injured, everything from flying debris and poison to terrorist attack and accidents and any number of ways, and they signed away their right to sue, and all of that is true. But as Mark makes the point, once these men were allegedly defrauded by Blackwater, that contract then becomes null and void. How is it that they ended up with only two men in each of those vehicles? How is it that they were ended up without armored vehicles in Fallujah? That's where the case of the other defendant, Justin McGowan, becomes very important. Scott Halvenston, for instance, one of the four guys who was killed, whose mother I've talked to extensively in the course of researching this piece. His great-great-uncle was Elihu Root, the former U.S. Secretary of War. He was a 1912 Nobel Peace Prize winner. These people came from a long family of proud, patriotic Republicans, and Scott was sort of the pride of his family. He was this guy on these reality TV shows. He trained Demi Moore for her movie G.I. Jane. And so he was sort of in a tough period, like a lot of these guys financially, and Blackwater offered a two-month contract. You go over there, you get paid $600 a day, you work for 60 straight days, you come back and you open up your fitness gym that you want to, and boom, you're off to the races. He was divorced, he had two kids he was supporting. So for him, there was this major financial motivation to go over there to Iraq. So he arrives at Blackwater's training facility in the first week of March of 2004. Now, mind you, this guy was a Navy SEAL for 12 years, four of them as an instructor. Well, the instructor that Blackwater provided, the trainer that Blackwater provided for Halvenston and the other men, was this guy, Justin McGowan, whose nickname we understand was Shrek, after the Green Ogre cartoon character. And the lawsuit alleges that he was far less qualified than the men he was supposed to be training. And he developed this sort of personal animosity towards Scott Halvenston, because Scott Halvenston was would sort of politely say, you know, why don't we do this or why don't we do that? And so he developed this animosity toward him. Well, when Halvenston gets over to Kuwait, a series of events take place that result in Justin McGowan being his supervisor, essentially managing the project that Scott Halvenston is organizing and then is working on. So Scott Halvenston arrives in Kuwait March 18th and begins training and working with his six-man team that he ultimately will deploy in Iraq with. Well, Justin McGowan calls him up on the night of, we believe, March 27th. Mind you, they were killed March 31st. Calls him up in Kuwait on the night of March 27th and says, pack your bags, you're leaving at 0500 with a different team, you're heading to Baghdad. And Scott Halvenston says, you know what, you're out of your mind. I'm not going to go with a different team. I mean, this is unheard of. And the lawsuit says, in fact, it was virtually unheard of for an individual to be removed from one team and placed on another and sent into a hostile territory within 24 hours. And so Justin McGowan was the one who, according to the lawsuit, intervened and said to Scott Halvenston under threat of being fired, you have to go and you have to go now. That night, Scott Halvenston sent an email to the owner and upper management of Blackwater that I have, in which he complained about Justin McGowan's conduct and said that his original team leader, the one who was part of his original six-man team, felt that there was agenda, quote, let's see if we can screw with Scott. And so Scott Halvenston was told, according to his mother and his emails, that he would have to repay all of the money he had made thus far, including his plane ticket back to the United States if he didn't go. So Scott Halvenston, you know, being a career Navy SEAL, said, I'm gonna make do with what I got. I need, you know, I'm here because I need this money. He heads off for Baghdad. Wasn't in the country even 48 hours before he went to Fallujah. The lawsuit also alleges that McGowan called the Blackwater manager in Baghdad, Tom Powell, and ordered that only four men be sent on that mission that day, and that two of them ended up staying back at Blackwater's Baghdad facility to do clerical work.
Now, why would that be, Mark? I mean, why would they have only sent, instead of this, three in each vehicle, why would they have only sent two in each vehicle?
Well, I think it's exactly what Jeremy is referring to, is that Justin McGowan was in a position of authority over Scott Halvenston. I mean, this is the ultimate office grudge. Prior to going over to Baghdad, Scott Halvenston was training with Justin McGowan. Justin McGowan was the instructor. And Scott, because of his expertise as a Navy SEAL, was actually politely suggesting that, hey, some of this training may be a little bit off. Why don't we do it this way? To help out the whole team. Well, Justin McGowan didn't take kindly to that, actually made notes in Scott, derogatory notes in Scott Halvenston's personnel file, and he basically didn't like the guy. He embarrassed him. He was a threat to them. Then fast forward a couple weeks, all of a sudden Justin McGowan is placed in a position of authority on this particular project over Scott Halvenston. And this was his opportunity to get rid of Scott Halvenston.
You actually think he really was going to try and get rid of him? Do you think at all that Blackwater was trying to save money by putting two people in the vehicle, or was much more the grudge thing?
Well,
you don't have to say you're the lawyer, so I know it. You know, I don't want you to commit. But
I think that the evidence will ultimately prove that it was a combination of both. We have the corporate greed aspect from Blackwater and cutting costs, not allowing them to have armored vehicles, not allowing them to sight their weapons, not allowing them to do pre-trip inspections and do ride-alongs with the security company that they were taking the contract over from. And then mix that in with the personal animosity of the person in charge of the program. And the combination of the two ultimately led to what happened.
Mark, can you explain what the Defense Base Act is and how that pertains to this case?
Absolutely. The Defense Base Act is essentially a federal workers' compensation scheme where, under some circumstances, employees of companies operating abroad are entitled to workers' compensation benefits. And if you fall within the categories of the workers of the Defense Base Act, or the DBA, those workers' compensation benefits are your exclusive remedy. That is exactly the position that Blackwater is taking in this case. They have committed wrongful conduct that has led to the death of four individuals. And essentially, they're sitting back and saying, you know what? You can't sue us. We've got insurance for it. Go talk to our insurance carrier. And of course, as we all know, benefits under workers' compensation are much less than you would normally be entitled to, and it doesn't take into account the reprehensibility of Blackwater's conduct.
I don't know whether Mark or Jeremy wants to answer this, but can you give us some sense of the role of private contractors in Iraq? What you think they're doing there? I mean, how that relates to the military? Is it just cowboys? What is it about, really?
I can take a stab at it. I don't know if Mark wants to add anything to this, but I don't have it in front of me. But I believe that during the Gulf War, approximately 1 in 90 of the combatants on the side of the United States were private, and now I believe it's something in the ballpark of 1 in 5. Mark, you could correct me if I'm wrong on that. But what we certainly have seen is an explosion of the privatization of war, where you have literally tens of thousands of mercenary types that are now roaming Iraq. Some of them are working for other private companies. Some, like Blackwater, have major contracts with the U.S. government to guard the ambassador. You know, these were the guys that got paid $21 million to guard Paul Bremer, the initial head of the U.S. occupation. Under George W. Bush, these private security firms have literally, it's marked a watershed moment for them. They have exploded. Blackwater, in fact, the president of the company, Gary Jackson, a few months after these killings happened, bragged of a staggering 600% growth corporate growth for Blackwater and said this is a $1 billion industry and Blackwater's only scratched the surface of it. The day after these killings happened, when Blackwater began the alleged stonewalling of these families, they viewed it as a profit moment. They hired the Alexander Strategy Group the day after these killings to manage their newfound fame. They started bringing on people like the former Pentagon Inspector General Joseph Schmitz. They hired the former CIA and State Department official Kofor Black, who recently was in Jordan representing Blackwater, bragging how they were going to start farming out to the highest bidder to engage in overt combat missions. Blackwater started a blimp division. They have an aviation division. These killings literally sparked a moment of extreme profit for the Blackwater Corporation. This company embodies so much of what has happened in this country in the war on terror. It's a company that was founded by a right-wing Christian fundamentalist named Eric Prince, who has given, I got his campaign finance records, over $250,000 in the course of his political career, never once has given a penny to a Democrat. That's fine. It's his right, but it's very unusual for the head of a corporation to have his bread only buttered on one side, and it's paid off so much so that in November of 2004, after George Bush won re-election, Gary Jackson, the president of Blackwater, sent out a celebratory email saying, George Bush wins, 4 more years, hooyah.
Mark, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, and what I would add to the broader question is, am I in a position to say whether or not the use of private contractors in Iraq is something that's beneficial? I don't know, frankly. But the problem is, there is no structure of accountability for the American companies and the contractors working over there. They may certainly provide a benefit to the armed forces. They may certainly be useful to the United States and the coalition over there in Iraq. But again, the system is flawed. There is no source of accountability. And then when you add into the mix the fact that American corporations have their hand in this and normally are concerned primarily with their profits and their bottom line, it creates chaos. We've seen situations here in our own country, such as Enron and WorldCom, where American corporations, based upon their corporate greed, have run awry. You take that and you mix it in to a situation where their workers are actually running around a war zone with guns, and it is absolute chaos.
You know, Mark, and I guess Jeremy, I'm at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we actually have a suit against two of the private contractors, Titan and Khaki, for their employees being allegedly involved in some of the torture stuff at Abu Ghraib, as well as other facilities. And, of course, we're meeting stiff opposition from them. But it is another example to me of corporations without really any kind of supervision of going in there and the military essentially allowing them almost to get away with stuff, at least in the Titan Khaki case.
And, Michael, I agree with that. And what I think it's important to understand is that this type of situation and the lack of accountability has transcended the normal overbilling of the government. As Jeremy referred to earlier, you may see this type of situation where these private contractors are making a ton of money, they may be overbilling the government and ultimately to the taxpayers' pain. I think everybody gets that. But now this has actually transcended that, and it's led to, in my case, 4 deaths of individuals, and in your case, the torture or potential torture of other human beings as well.
No, I think that's right. I want to really thank you for being with us. And Mark, is there any place people can get more information on this? They can read Jeremy's article, I know.
Mark, on your website, you also have a bunch of articles, including the excellent GQ article that was written on it, because that's hard to find online, but you guys have it on your website, if you can tell us.
Yeah, we have several links at callahan-law.com, or if you type in Callahan and Blaine, you can find our website. And Jeremy's article is a great source. The GQ article is a great source. And there's also a one-hour frontline documentary out there, which we on our website can provide you more information to, where people can really find out exactly what's going on. Because although we deal with it on a day-to-day basis, I'm constantly finding out that Americans are not aware of this situation and are actually shocked when pieces like Jeremy's come out.
Well, thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Heidi and Mike.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Take care.
We've all been hearing a lot about global warming, the melting Arctic, the effect on polar bears, etc. And of course, we all know the Bush administration has said there's no such thing, or if there is such thing, it's, quote, not our fault or not the fault of the United States. The United States has, of course, refused to support the Kyoto Accords, has refused to cut down on CO2 emissions, etc. Recently, of course, it's coming up much more a man named James Hansen, who's the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, has made a strong case for global warming, not in favor of it, but that it is going on, and that it is the product of emissions really caused from people, cars, etc. Recently, our producer, Jeff Brady, went up to Albany, where there was a catastrophic climate change forum. Among the speakers at that forum were Dr. James Hansen. He listened to a man named Donald Goldberg. Donald Goldberg is an attorney, and one of the reasons we're bringing you this segment on Law and Disorder is Donald Goldberg is the attorney in a lawsuit that has been filed against various administration officials, etc., for not complying with various treaties regarding the cutting back of CO2 emissions. So, for example, even though we haven't signed the Kyoto Accord, there are other treaties the U.S. has signed that requires a lowering of our CO2 emissions. Goldberg will describe the effects of global warming and the violation of human rights in the lawsuit that he's filed, and that's on behalf of the Inuit. The Inuit are colloquially sometimes known as Eskimos, or sometimes in a derogatory way. They are called the Inuit. They're spread across, really, the Northern Hemisphere, from Greenland, Northern Canada, and into Alaska. He filed the petition at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and that petition alleges that the United States has violated fundamental human rights by failing to reduce greenhouse gases.
This is the Arctic ice cap. The white is what was there in 2003. Actually, 2004, it was even a little more dramatic. That red line, that's where the ice cap was in the same season in 1979. That's about a 40% reduction. The thing that almost since I first got involved with this issue most boggles my mind is that we only have seen so far about an increase in atmospheric concentrations of about one-third, a little more than one-third. So that's what's driving the warming that we're seeing today. And as was explained earlier, some of that is in the bank. Some of that warming we haven't felt yet. Policymakers think that a really, really tough target would be doubling. So whatever is causing this, imagine three times. Imagine that multiplied by three. What is that going to cause? This was a study done by the U.S. Government Accountability Office. They actually went to see how many only Alaskan villages. There are many, many more in Canada, and some in Greenland, some in northeastern Russia. But how many? They went to see how many of these Inuit villages, native villages, not all of them Inuit, in Alaska, are at risk of the same fate that we saw Shishmaref is suffering, and they counted 184. With a relocation cost of $100 to $400 million, not total, but each. I doubt that Inuit altogether have enough money to move one village. When the U.S. government, after having done a lot of its own research, independent of the IPCC, because the administration really didn't believe the results of the IPCC, had to report to the Conference of the Parties of the Framework Convention. That's the treaty that we still adhere to. The Framework Convention came first. The Kyoto Protocol came under the Framework Convention, much like the Montreal Protocol that Jim was talking about. That report makes it as clear as any other scientific report we've had what the danger is. And actually, there have been some reports even since then, official government reports, U.S. government reports, that do not downplay this problem. We know there have been instances of more political reports that did downplay it. But the hard science, which is what you'll find if you go to an EPA website or a DOE website or a NOAA website, is, I think, completely in sync with all the science that the Kyoto Protocol was based on, that the administration claimed junk science.
We want to take this opportunity to remind all our listeners of the anti-war demonstration Saturday, April 29th in New York City. We want it to be massive, hundreds of thousands of people. The assembly point is 22nd and Broadway. The assembly time is 10:30 to noon. The march will begin at 12 noon. The demands of the march are ending the war in Iraq, bringing the troops home now, standing up for immigrant and women's rights. This demonstration, while it's a major demonstration in New York, we should also understand that there are demonstrations every day all around this country, which is what it's going to take to end that war in Iraq.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work. Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady.